Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Vice President J.D. Vance left Islamabad without a deal, as the Americans like to put it. It was always unlikely any progress would be made to end the war the U.S. and Israel started. Clearly, this conflict is far from over. Also, NATO has fallen on hard times. We explain why. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli, in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we have Mark Sloboda. He's an international relations and security analyst. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's kick it off with Mark here. What did we just experience in Islamabad? 21 hours of marathon talks, apparently. I don't think it was very well described, this whole endeavor. This was a process of starting a process, and it didn't go anywhere. It didn't yield any kind of results. Was it supposed to, or was it just theater?
I think that the United States believed that Iran has perhaps been pummeled to the point where they might be willing to accept certain U.S. demands. And I believe principal among those is opening the Strait of Hormuz to Western traffic. It has been selectively closed by Iran, closed to U.S. and Israeli and other Western affiliated traffic. And that has caused a great deal of harm to the global energy markets and to the world. And also heading into the ceasefire talks, even for the ceasefire and the talks, Iran had two demands. One was that the ceasefire be extended to Lebanon as well, which the Israelis, and after Trump originally vouched for the Israelis, they were not a party to the discussions to begin the ceasefire and the talks. Israel refused, and then later Trump backed up Israel on their continuing, really, carpet bombing and ethnic cleansing of southern Lebanon, of the Shia. In fact, they specifically warned Christians and Druze in Lebanon not to hide Shia Muslims in their attics, which has insane parallels to the treatment of Jews in Europe during the reign of Nazi Germany, which I think says a lot. The other demand was that the U.S. has to release the frozen assets that Iran has abroad. And supposedly that was agreed to. The U.S. certainly hasn't been making a big deal of it. But that right away shows us that Iran has the leverage. It was the U.S. that wanted these ceasefire talks, that pushed for them and had to make concessions just for Iran to agree to them. And there's no reason for Iran to agree, to trust, to place any credibility in anything the U.S. says. The last two times they were in talks, the U.S. and Israel conducted sneak attacks. And there was an article on the front pages of the Washington Post urging Trump to assassinate the Iranian diplomats if they failed to agree to what Trump was demanding. That's where the U.S. is operating from.
Yeah, the Israelization of the Trump foreign policy. George, I mean, what I found very disappointing, and I can't help but fall back on theater here. J.D. Vance was just harping away about the nuclear file, which has already been quite well resolved if we look at the Omani influence right before the conflict started. So, I mean, again, was there good faith? We're here in good faith. It was good faith. If you have to say you were there in good faith, it probably means you weren't, George.
I think that's right. But it's hard to believe that it was, in fact, the nuclear file that was the sticking point, because it's probably, from what can gather, the sticking point was Israel, which is that was the issue that, you know, the Pakistani prime minister, when he announced the ceasefire, was quite explicit that this will entail Israel and Lebanon. And so all of this time, Israel has, of course, not agreed to this. And then Trump, who seemed to agree with the Pakistani prime minister's interpretation, then went back on it. So I think it was the Israeli aspect of it that was the sticking point. And obviously, the vice president of the United States can't very well just announce that, well, the sticking point is Israel rather than our demands. But I think that was what the Iranians said. Well, if you can't control Israel, if Israel is just going to continue doing whatever it wants to do, then what is the point of our negotiating with you? I mean, you know, you're supposed to be the chief. Now, the fact that this broke down after, 21 hours, that doesn't mean that the ceasefire will immediately break down. I mean, it's As far as Iran and the United States are concerned, it is a ceasefire. And Israel has also not attacked Iran. So there is a ceasefire between Israel and Iran, Iran and the United States. It's it's just Lebanon that there's no ceasefire. So that doesn't mean that will come to an immediate end. So there may yet be further rounds of negotiations, but ultimately the Israel issue is going to have to be resolved.
Yeah.
Because either the United States speaks on behalf of Israel, or Israel just conducts its own independent foreign policy.
Or its own independent war.
Yes.
Mark, I'm titling this program No Peace, No War, obviously going back to Brest-Litovsk when the Soviets were negotiating the end of their involvement in the First World War. No peace, no war. Is that what we have right now?
Yes, but I would say only by a razor-thin margin, and I don't expect it to last. While the talks were ongoing, the U.S. staged a stunt, a provocation. They sent two destroyers into, supposedly across the Strait of Hormuz. That's what the U.S. claims. Iran claims that they never crossed the Strait of Hormuz, that they were warned to and turned back at the last moment. In the hours since the talks have broken down with no progress, Trump has released another one of his unhinged megalomaniacal social media posts. And he's talking once again now about sending the U.S. Navy into the Strait of Hormuz to essentially force it open. He's actually talking a lot about mines. Actually, there's no indication that Iran has massively mined the Strait of Hormuz. Here's part of the problem is that in order to effectively stop traffic through the Strait of Hormuz, Iran doesn't need to put a blockade of ships across the strait and keep them there. All they need to do is launch attacks, occasional attacks on with drones or missiles or anti-ship cruise missiles on any ship that they do not give permission to cross the straits when it tries to do so. And that alone will make sure that the insurance companies simply don't issue the insurance, right? It's called an insurance blockade. It has proven extremely effective for the Iranians' purposes. However, if the U.S. reignites a conflict by attempting that, it is almost certain, as the Iranians have said, that they will move themselves the next step up the escalation ladder, and they will have the Ansar Allah movement, the Houthis in Yemen, close the Bab al-Mandab Straits across the Red Sea. And if we think that the global energy markets, the global shipping industry is hurting now, and what we're told is the biggest energy shock the world has ever experienced, everyone buckle up. Because we're looking at global depression time if that happens.
Yeah, George, the cynic in me, and particularly when it comes to this administration and looking at the data points of who's buying put options and whatnot every few days at the end of the week before the start of the next week here. I mean, you can say maybe progress, maybe no progress, maybe one step forward, two step back, but it's market manipulation. That's the only tangible thing I can see here is, again, more market manipulation. And if you have insider information, you're going to the bank.
No, I think that's right. But that's why, in a way, I mean, Trump has steadied the markets with the announcement of the ceasefire and the negotiation in Islamabad. But he has limited room in which to maneuver, because if he were then, after the lapse of the ceasefire or even before, to launch this a renewed attack on Iran, nothing much will change. And therefore, everything is going to tank once again, and he will be in exactly the same position as he was before, which is that he's unable to resolve his problems. He's unable to force any concessions on Iran. And it was clear from the negotiations, Iran is not in the mood to concede. So Trump is, you know, hands are tied. Because, yeah, okay, we can start all over again, and we're going to, you know, fire and brimstone and all the rest. But the outcome will be no better for the United States than it was before. So he does have very limited room in which to maneuver. So that's why I think the more likely outcome is that there's just going to be, I mean, I think, as you put it, neither peace nor war. After the ceasefire, we'll just continue with this the state of hostility and preparations maybe for restarting it, but it won't be restarted in the very near future. I think if the United States restarts it, it's going to take some time. They're going to need time
to
replenish their forces.
But meanwhile, the Strait of Hormuz, quote unquote, is closed. Yeah. See, that's it. Yeah. I mean, you can have all your plans. See, this is what, Mark, this way I think is that the Trump people, and you know, Israel is always a separate conversation, but they're thinking tactically how to manage. The Iranians are thinking strategically. We've been in a box for 47 years and we're breaking out, and we have the time. You may have the clocks, but we have the time, Mark.
That is exactly correct, because the U.S. and Israel obviously betrayed the agreement for the ceasefire negotiations with these escalated attacks on Lebanon. And basically, they just moved everything that was attacking Iran, and they have simply been mass bombing of residential buildings in southern Lebanon. At one point, there was 100 strikes in 10 minutes in the initial bombing. So mass deaths. The way Iran has responded to that, first, they were talking launching retaliatory strikes against Israel, or at least the occupied territories of Palestine bordering Lebanon, shall we say. But then they thought better. And what they did instead is actually tightened their stranglehold on the Strait of Hormuz so that there was no traffic going through. There was less traffic going through the Strait of Hormuz now, no one, than there was during the height of the fighting. And here Iran is recognizing where they have the leverage over the United States, and that's over the global energy markets, right? That's what Trump is desperately concerned about. So they tightened their fist there, and that is leaving Trump with no good options. He cannot continue as it is. He's got to launch military actions or accede to Iranian demands.
And neither one is very clear at this point which way he's going to go. But this is far from over. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To mind you, we're discussing some real news. And that real news, George, is NATO. It's falling on hard times. The General Secretary, Mark Rutte, was in Washington for 4 days. A real humiliation exercise, looking at it from the outside. He's walking a very, very thin tightrope. I don't think he's doing a very good job. So I basically set it up for you, George. What's in play, George?
Well, what's in play is for the United States to continue to underwrite NATO's project. NATO's project is the continuation of this war with Russia. That's its only preoccupation. It's during the past week, we had a number of blustery statements from the UK government about Russian submarines, Russian threats to the British Isles. This it's a constant drumbeat. We had Kaya Kallas coming out again. Russia. They are the NATO, the European NATO member states are absolutely livid that Trump has got himself bogged down in this war in the Middle East. They don't care about the Middle East. They kind of felt that they burnt their fingers during the Gulf War II. They don't want to go back to that. They want to focus on Russia. And they can't get anywhere with Trump because Trump is telling them, well, you know, I'm not that interested in Ukraine. That's your project. I'm ready to help you with Ukraine, but then you need to help us with our project, which is the Middle East, even though Trump had, you know, had campaigned on staying out of any more wars in the Middle East. So the Europeans are just angry that the United States is focusing on something other than Russia. And I say, when are you going to get back to focusing on Russia? And we have Chancellor Merz talking about, well, you know, about the Golden Horn, you know, we've got to think about the Constitution and UN Security Council resolution. None of these things has Germany ever thought about
exactly.
On the wars that Germany wants to get involved in, whether it was in, you know, back in the 90s with Yugoslavia or when it was Ukraine. But suddenly the German government is very, very preoccupied with the Constitution and the UN Security Council. So the Europeans, obviously, they want to see the back of Trump, but they want the United States focusing once again on their bête noire, which is Russia.
You know, Mark, all three of us are on Twitter X here, and, you know, the issue of NATO and its future and its mission and all that, we have all chimed in on at one point or another. But over the last 40 days or so, we kind of sitting on the bleachers there and let everybody else tear themselves to pieces over it. It's actually quite good theater here. What's the lay of the land, Mark?
During the first Trump administration, there was what was recognized as a major transatlantic rift, a rift between Europe and the United States. And that rift is one really, it's not about Europe or the U.S. diverting from U.S.-led Western global hegemony. It's more, shall we say, the tone of the relationship mm-hmm. and the prioritization mm-hmm. of the goals of that relationship. The tone, Trump obviously doesn't treat the European members as allies. He treats them as vassals. And perhaps they always were, but he's rather rubbing their face in that fact. He's rather, I would say, diplomatically crude in that regard, even if it is that one bit I do find amusing, I must admit to. The other part, of course, is the prioritization, right? Europe was led by the Blinken and Sullivan administration into a de facto war with Russia. And then Trump comes into office and says, yeah, that's not my priority, right? That's low down the list for me. Yeah, the CIA can continue to whatever they want to do, but my priority is China. Oh my God, Israel. Oh, sorry. I'm jumping off to the Middle East, right? And so the priority has become the Middle East, even though that wasn't even what they intended, supposedly, when they took office. And it is this prioritization. And it's because these conflicts both have global order shifting endgame consequences. It's that shift in prioritization is a big deal. The Europeans think they can wait Trump out and that the next U.S. president, a Democrat, a Marco Rubio, as long as it's not J.D. Vance, will return to their proper hegemonic masters.
Yeah, well, the world can change a great deal between now and
3 years.
Yeah. Well, you know, George, I mean, I think the three of us are quite well-known skeptics here. I mean, for the Europeans, NATO's the only game in town, so they're just going to have to eat crow. I mean, there's nothing they can really do about it. They have saddled themselves into a security arrangement in which they have lost sovereignty, agency, they don't have any money. They don't think strategically, Stockholm syndrome on steroids, this devotion to daddy in the White House here. It's hard to feel sorry for them. And, Donald Trump has gotten himself into such a mess right now. He's not going to do them any favors. And by the way, everyone, what was NATO supposed to do to open the Strait of Hormuz? With what? With yachts of the rich, George?
No, they don't have anything. And that's what's so amusing, that they're openly admitted that, hey, we don't really have anything at our disposal, and we're not going to take any risks sending our naval vessels in.
That was America's job. That's the deal. America takes the risk.
But we're willing to take risks sending our forces into Ukraine. So it's like, we don't want this war. We don't want to get into a shooting war with Iran, but we're ready to get into a shooting war with Russia.
As long as America is there.
That's exactly right. As long as America. And that's what they're hoping for. And I think Mark is right. They're waiting out Trump. They're thinking that, there's less than 3 years and he's going to be replaced by someone else. They're figuring probably, as things look, the Democrats will take over in 2029. The Democrats generally have been much more Atlanticist, much more accommodating to the Europeans than the Republicans have been. And they figure, things will get back to normal. And, they're probably hoping and praying that Trump may be removed even before that, and then things will somehow get back to normal. But that without Russia, that project just collapses. I mean, Europe has defined itself. It's now completely defined itself in opposition to Russia. There's nothing else to Europe now other than hatred for Russia and a desire to go on in this for a decades-long twilight struggle against Russia.
Yeah, but, Mark, if you were a serious person in Europe thinking about security, you would see with the advent of this war of choice against Iran, the United States, for all of its talk of security pacts and all of that, didn't protect the Gulf countries, pulling out weapon systems from Asia, where I thought there was supposed to be a pivot to Asia. I mean, if you were a smart, sober European, which in the leadership that doesn't exist these days here, you'd say, what is this guarantee actually really worth?
That's the problem, is that there aren't any sane, sober, serious people in political power in Europe. Instead, what you have is an ideological maxim that utterly dictates the reactions of the European political elite practically across the board. Orban, who's fighting for his political survival in elections in Hungary today, and Fico as the outliers, but they are committed to the supremacist messianic belief in Western exceptionalism that tells them that they are structurally, societally, and above all, morally superior to every other state, civilization, what have you, in the world. And therefore, even to make any concessions or compromises with them would be a moral fault. They really believe that. They wholeheartedly believe.
Their ideology is a purity test.
Yes. And it so inhibits their foreign policy and has led them down a military and economic path of suicide. As Orban said, not shooting yourself in the foot with these sanctions, but shooting yourself in the lungs.
George, you live in Hungary. It's a small country, wonderful country, beautiful country. Budapest is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. But I don't really think of Hungary as kind of a geopolitical, major piece on the board here. But apparently for, countless number of non-Hungarians commenting on the election in the country that you live in now, this is all important. This is, this is existential. Humanity's at stake here in this election, apparently, if you look at the media.
No, I think it is for them. I think they see that if Orban goes down, what goes down with him is Orbanism and therefore a kind of nationalist populism that sees Europe, as the way Europe used to be, kind of pragmatic, you know, able to negotiate with adversaries, able to, you know, live with those who don't share its ideology. But now Europe is completely subsumed under this kind of universalist liberal ideology. And Orban is just this sore point that really, you know, antagonizing them on their two key issues. The two key issues are, which is migration. They're absolutely committed on essentially a population replacement. I mean, they pretend that they're not for it. Yes, of course, that's exactly their project. Population replacement, that's one project. And the second project is an eternal war against Russia. Russia is seen as the other, as a kind of the anti-liberal state. They don't want to have anything to do with it. And, you know, Orban stands in the way. And I think once he goes, and, you know, those two defining ideological projects, mass migration and the twilight struggle against Russia, will just have, you know, there'll be all opposition to them will disappear.
10 seconds, Mark.
It's also about sovereignty. Orban challenges the EU's control over foreign policy. He wants to bring it back to the European states.
All right, gentlemen, every time we convene, we talk about the most depressing things facing humanity. But I would like to send my congratulations on Easter to both of you, okay? All right, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and here in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.